Hi, friends. Welcome back. It's great to speak with you once again. I hope you had a great weekend. It's always an honor to have you with us. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and we do three shows a week. And every other week, one of these is going to be Radio 314. Well, sometimes we do those a bit more frequent. You can find us on redicecreations.com and also redicesradio.net. We are on Stitcher, YouTube, and looking at expanding to SoundCloud and TuneIn as well. First hour, always free, sometimes both, but when you want the full broadcast, both hours and all the video material and everything else, you can find us on redicemembers.com for everything in one place. You also have radio314.com for Lana's latest shows. Today our topic is something different. We are going to speak about Soviet/Russia relations with the United States and other countries. We are going to get into the history of conflict and espionage, the Cold War, and talk about the elite of Soviet-Russian intelligence services and detail events and old geopolitical strategies that have been part of the conflict going way back. We have with us Mark Hackard. He's an independent foreign policy analyst. He earned a BA, Bachelor's of Arts in Russian Language from Georgetown University, and an MA, Master's of Arts in Russian, Eastern European, and Eurasian Studies from Stanford University. He studied the intersection of political culture, religion, and strategic issues, which he approaches from a traditionalist conservative position. Welcome, Mark. Thank you for being here. It's nice to speak with you today. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, thank you, Henrik. Great to speak with you.
You bet. Now, you did a good show with Lana on 314 here about Dostoevsky a few months ago that I enjoyed very much. And you guys spoke, of course, about souloftheeast.org. And I guess today we're going to kind of continue a bit on the East and West discussion, if you will, and talk about some of the things that you write about, among other things, on your other website, espionagehistoryarchive.com. We've linked to a couple of stories from there as well. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about the site and I guess your interest in this topic before we get into the meat of our discussion, Mark?
Sure. Espionage History Archive is devoted to showing English-speaking audiences the history of Russian intelligence, and that includes the Cold War, which I've devoted a lot of focus to, as well as other periods of history like the 19th century Great Game or the Napoleonic Wars. There's a lot to cover there, and there's a lot of different segments that I'm studying, or rather that I'm conveying to Western audiences. So I hope they'll enjoy that and enjoy true spy stories that I translate from books on Russian intelligence, including memoirs by former KGB officers, as well as articles and official accounts from the archives of Russian intelligence.
Very interesting. You brought up the Great Game. I was looking into this the other day. We were talking about the what's known as the geographical pivot of history. Or the Heartland Theory, right? That's from Halford Mackinder, and I think he wrote that in 1904 or something. And it kind of has to do with this, the idea that Russia is a major, it's right smack on top of what they call the pivot area, tons of resources, and then you have kind of perimeters from there. But do you think that all of this, even the political intrigue that we see today, that it kind of goes back to this idea of the Great Game, that if you can control this landmass, you have a strategically an upper hand, so to speak?
Yes, absolutely. And the Heartland continues to occupy central focus of different great powers' geostrategies. So if you look at U.S. national security directives and doctrines going back to the beginning of the Cold War under Truman, you have the Heartland Theory of Mackinder informing U.S. national security strategy as far as the so-called containment plans of the Soviet Union and how the United States wanted to approach the Soviet challenge. In addition, I think that Mackinder's theory is very useful, and it's a great analysis. At the same time, it goes deeper than what we're told in Western thought or in Western geopolitical writings about how the heartland is the threat. I think the heartland is the target, that the Eurasian heartland is the key to world power, in the sense that it must be dominated by modern Western powers, in particular the Anglo-American condominium, that this has been articulated not only by Mackinder, but also other geopoliticians, including Nicholas Spykman, and of course, in our own day, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yeah.
That the heartland must be, in fact, dominated by the maritime sea powers, the liberal thalassocracies, the United States and Britain, but mainly, of course, today and for the entire second half of the 20th century, of course, the Pax Americana, that heartland must be put under Atlantic powers control in order for there to form a true world state, a world government. That's the ultimate goal, is complete and total world power.
And so it's this area that, because we see this spring up again and again, and we'll get to some of the conflicts that we've seen now with Russia throughout, and you know, it's as true today than that was in the 80s, you know. But is it a resource question? Is it just a obviously we understand the idea of world government and the idea that the Western powers are seeking to subjugate as many as they can under its own thumb of rulership, if you will. But is there something else going on? Is it just resources, or is it just a strategic thing? What do you think?
I think it's all of the above. It's resources. So the energy networks of Eurasia, and those resources, oil, natural gas, as well as precious metals and minerals, are very crucial. As well as the strategic question, you have of course Russia with its nuclear arsenal, and its position as a great power is going to be an independent actor in any normal circumstances. It's going to project influence. It's going to defend and advance its interests. But what the Western agenda entails is not even the interests, say, of our own peoples, whether they be Americans or Britons or Swedes or anything like that, but rather it's just the very narrow interests of a financial oligarchy that runs the show in the West and has been for centuries. So Eurasia makes for the ultimate prize of the contest for world power. So the resources really feed into a larger picture of strategic dominance over the Eurasian landmass.
So it's not about obviously trying to advance or lift forth or give Western man an opportunity above all else. It's simply the structure we're talking about is simply using the West, because it's here that it managed to get a foothold. Would you say that's correct?
I'd say that's correct, yes. I think that when you hear in the media people speaking about American interests in Eurasia or U.S. objectives for say Central Asia or even the Middle East or wherever, these goals are not even done with our interests in stake. There's no connection to popular well-being, saying of the people. None of this matters. It's only the narrow goals of of a tiny technocratic oligarchic elite that seeks to impose its will on the rest of the world. So, but unfortunately, as we see in the press, all this is conflated into a contest between nation states, when in reality, nation states are simply being used to advance a much more insidious agenda.
Yep, you're absolutely right. We'll kind of lead through. Let's kind of talk about the timeline a bit here, or you know what has happened if we look at the great game in consideration. But what's your view then on how the Soviet Empire emerged out of this with what happened during the Bolshevik Revolution? And there's various attempts throughout history of trying to control and subjugate not only the people, but obviously then take control over the region. But maybe you can speak a little bit about the formation of how, you know, revolutionary Russia came together.
Sure. I think that the popular narrative that we're given in the West, and that of course the Soviet Communist Party promoted during its day, really leaves out a lot of crucial points that would tell us the fuller story, the fuller truth of how Soviet power came to be. And I think it's really important to take into account the fact that the Western banking elite, financial oligarchs, were really the main backers of the Bolshevik Revolution, and they made it happen. We have banking houses in New York and London, people like Schiff as well as Kudin Loeb, who financed the Bolsheviks to the tune of millions. And we have the correspondence of Trotsky and his passage from America to Russia, and that included the financing, training, and equipping of revolutionary brigades under Trotsky's command, and that was all done in America with American financial backing.
Don't forget, Mark, I just want to mention, but you had one sitting in Stockholm. He was actually Jewish, Olof Aschberg. He has a grandson today, by the way, who's have a TV show. He's in control of the large portion of the media in Sweden. But anyway, he became head of Ruskombank. He was called the first Soviet international bank, and he actually was very instrumental. He was the leftist sympathizer, and he helped to finance the Bolsheviks in Russia as well. And I think that's a key and a really important thing. But obviously, you're right. Yeah. I mean, there's tons of interests around in the West that made the thought to make sure this is going to happen right, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And the scholarship of Anthony Sutton, of course, is very good in that regard. And we need to really remember that the goal was always the overthrow of the Tsar and the destruction of the traditional regime, the ancient regime in Russia, and its replacement with a modern state that would be under the control of international financial interests. The goal was to centralize financial flows and make Russia's resources available to those very same international elites.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's interesting how they pulled this off, and of course how much tremendous amounts of pain and suffering that has been left in its wake. And I mean, when we look at Russia today, I mean, do you think it's just kind of a remnant of what it might have been if we hadn't entered into this particular period in history of decimating so many Russians? I mean, I looked at even the demographics the other day.
Yes.
And I was just amazed that it's still, you know, so many Russians in Russia, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is truly amazing. The war, World War I and the revolution were just utterly horrific tragedies. And had they not happened, yes, Russia would have been even stronger and would have had a much larger population. All these factors should be looked at. At the same time, I think it is amazing that Russia even has survived as it has, and through the entire 20th century with all its bloodshed and all its murder and massive upheaval. So today, Russia, the fact that it is, in fact, in many ways, an independent actor, and that its population is still surviving and fighting to live another day, I think that says a lot just about the human spirit, just that one particular case. Of course, there are others, but the Russian case really should be cause for hope for any people that seeks to defend its heritage and project itself into the future.
Now, let me ask you a little bit about how you think Americans view. Well, I mean, it's a big topic and it's changed over time. It's transforming all the time. But you know, I'm of two sides, I guess, at the same time here, because one part of me does see the detrimental effects of communism and how this was helped to be distributed with the aid of Russians or the Soviets, we should call them, I guess. And the other side of me is like, it's a population that has been tremendously victimized by this political ideology, and maybe even people who were part of the structure necessarily wasn't, you know, kind of all there. But if we take an example, the Americans, the television show, is a really good way of showing, you know, the suspicion, obviously, as well, of what Americans might feel today. They're kind of playing on this in the TV show a little bit, that it's a fear that, you know, oh my God, the Reds are coming. But then at the same time, these were and are realities, maybe not today as much, but definitely in the 80s. But the TV show was kind of a way for them to, I read a couple of reviews of it, and they said, you know, finally someone is making communism sexy, they said, by putting, you know, Kerry Russell in that part and whatnot. And it's a way of kind of, I don't know, it felt like it was a way of softening up this whole episode. What's your view on it?
Well, I don't think that communism is sexy, certainly. I really hold the view that communism was an enormous tragedy and led to dislocations in the lives of millions, killed millions, and also was really implemented with the goal of exterminating the faith of an entire people. So that to me, of course, I'm not in any way sympathetic with communism. But at the same time, when you see, say, the recent parade on Red Square on May 9th, mm-hmm. you had the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. I don't think, and you'll notice, the Russians had their vintage World War II uniforms. They had the hammer and sickle out, and so on, all the symbolism. I don't think that's a celebration of communism at all, but rather a historical remembrance of what their ancestors had achieved, that victory in an enormously terrible war that really was a war of extermination. And so they were tremendously fortunate to survive. And that really is what that's about.
So it's not about softening up the image of communism again, using that for political purposes, because doesn't it at the same time kind of play into the hands of the West, legitimizing their fears to a certain extent?
It's interesting you say that about softening up communism. If anything, there maybe in Hollywood or in Washington, D.C., there might be some people who want to make communism sexy. I don't think for the purpose of making the Russians look good, but rather for whatever political agenda they might have. I think that could be the angle. But the show The Americans is interesting. I think it was done with some very concrete geopolitical type oriented propaganda goals in place. We know that I think the producer of the show, or maybe it's the director, and very much so the consultants, are connected with CIA in one measure or another.
I can mention his name, Joe Weisberg. He's an American television writer and producer, but he's a former CIA officer, and his brother is editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. I think he quit now, but his name is Jacob Weisberg, and there's a little bit of detail here that's quite interesting. It's not too long, but just they graduated from Yale University, or his brother did, I guess, Jacob Weisberg, in 1986. But what's interesting here is that, you know, we always hear about the evils of, like, you know, Skull and Bones and whatnot at Yale, but some of these gentlemen here actually dismissed Skull and Bones to go and join another secret society called the Elihu Society that we never hear about. It's very interesting, but it's basically the, you know, if Skull and Bones is the fake plastic conservative, you know, group who occupy the spot of being the controlled opposition on the right, you know, then the Elihu Society is the left version of Skull and Bones, if you will.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had not heard of the Elihu Society. Okay.
So they were pushing, like, progressivism and, you know, so-called diversity back in, like, 1903, 1910, something like that.
Okay.
So they started early. So
there you go. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just cut a long story short there. Very interesting connections between these gentlemen, and his father was a big media, you know, mogul as well, I believe. So that's kind of the environment that the Americans come out of. So what more can you say about the TV show?
Right. Well, as you see, media, psychological warfare, information operations, intelligence, influence operations, all these things tie together. And they run in the same currents, and the same people are occupying various positions that deal with promoting certain agendas. So with the TV show The Americans, you have the setting is the 1980s, and you have a couple of Soviet deep cover intelligence officers infiltrated into the United States and living the lives of Americans and posing as normal American citizens. That is a very interesting premise, because that really did happen and does happen. It's very unique to the Soviet Russian, now Russian, intelligence system. The Americans are a real example of what are called the illegals, illegal intelligence officers, people who infiltrate target countries under false identities, oftentimes as citizens of those countries, and are so well trained in the language and in other espionage techniques that they take on completely the identity of the citizens of that country. They become pure Americans or pure Canadians or Germans or Frenchmen or whoever it might be. It's pretty amazing. These are very real cases. So the CIA in that respect is showing a real instance of Russian tradecraft. This is how Russian/Soviet intelligence really has worked over the years. The political agenda, of course, is another matter, and I'm sure that they will insert whatever messages they like into the program to drive their point home the way they'd like.
Well, it's interesting, Mark, because obviously, as you say, the infiltration is real, and throughout the TV show, we kind of learn to I've seen some of the episodes. We learn to kind of sympathize with the characters, and what's very fascinating to me. And let me know if this is jumping ahead here, but it seems that there has been a flip of ideology. Ironically, just as what you said, while Russia today, you know, bring out the hammer and sickle in one of these parades. You know, as you said, okay, the question mark is, are they communist today? you know, But then if you look at the mentality of America, I'm not saying that they're full-on communist, but if we go back to the 50s and 60s in America, there were, you know, the Treasury, other parts of the American government was riddled with communists. You know, Harry Dexter White and, you know, some of these people. And so they have managed to get into America and steered it politically into a direction which is, you know, more closer to communism today than it was back in the 50s and 60s. Wouldn't you agree?
You know, I'd say that's interesting. I would posit it thus that really I wouldn't say that America was influenced to a great degree to become super leftist from the infiltration of communist agents so much as this might be the natural course. I think it's very much more just the natural direction of liberal democracy, of where it goes.
Right. Yeah.
And so the presence of Soviet agents was, as we see in the 50s, was accompanied by the Red Scare. So clearly Americans were not happy about communist infiltration, but at the same time, the ideology of liberal democracy of the Enlightened Republic also has its own direction and leads in a certain way. And so I think that what we see today, the growing totalitarian tendencies within American society are more a natural outgrowth of its founding ideology more than anything.
Interesting.
I think it's unfortunate that it's happening, but I don't think it's even necessarily a matter of external influence as much as it is the kind of the natural course of where revolutionary ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity, where those ultimately lead. We could look at France, right? Revolutionary France, mm-hmm. and see how quickly all that collapsed into chaos, and then Napoleon's tyranny, and how that developed in the United States and in England. We're supposedly very conservative, and so the American Revolution was supposedly a quote-unquote conservative revolution and didn't lead to massive bloodshed or dictatorship. Yet at the same time, I think it's just much slower in being enacted. Yeah. That this is a gradualist program, and that it is leading to the same sorts of places. The monk Seraphim Rose pointed out something very interesting. He said he was an American Orthodox monk and kind of a personal hero of mine. He died in 82. Mm-hmm. So I was just a child when he passed away, but he was a very brilliant, intelligent man. And he said the American ideal is Disneyland, but it will develop into the gulag. And it's very sad and unfortunate that such things are taking place, but we can kind of see that across the space of our life where things develop. And that of course makes me sad because I love America, and it's a beautiful land, and there are wonderful people here. But again, ideas and political ideologies and philosophies matter. And so enacting revolutionary principles, the same ones that really present in the French Revolution, it doesn't matter if we apply them in a slower, gradualist program, they still lead ultimately to the same sorts of places. So I really think that even though you have the presence of communist agents in the 50s, say in the United States, and of course in the 30s and 40s before that, but then you also have the Frankfurt School coming over And that was not a matter of, say, of the actions of communist agents. That was the OSS that brought them in. So that was U.S. intelligence. And then the CIA. And the CIA also worked with the Frankfurt School on psychological warfare. And that includes modern art. I mean, it's amazing. You can go read these articles about how the CIA sponsored modern art. And all this was done, not only, of course, the excuse back then was we've got to propagandize the evil Soviets and really infiltrate their psychological process and ultimately disintegrate their regime. These are weapons that are applied against our own populations.
Well, exactly. And we can get stuck in, I get stuck sometimes in nomenclature and discussing ideology, but I think we shouldn't forget that a lot of these people, those who are seeking to control on a geopolitical level, I think they don't really care what kind of system is in place, really. They want to have power and they want to achieve that in any means necessary. And they use whatever they have to use at the time to advance their agenda. And that's why it might be confusing for us on the outside sometimes. We're trying to pin it. Wait a minute, is it communism? Is it, liberal? What's going on here? But it's like, it doesn't really matter, right?
Yes, at the end of the day. I think that's exactly right. Ideology for the small elite that really drives the history of the West and is seeking to really extend its power over the entire world. And they're very close to that, unfortunately. But ideologies are playthings for these people. So liberal democracy, as we can see, really doesn't live up to its promises. And what is its essence? Its essence is oligarchy. That's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with oligarchs who will use all these various ideologies, and you can see it in say, neo, anything from neo-fascism to the so-called Islamic State, the caliphate in the Middle East, to Pussy Riot, to feminist groups in the West, and so on. These are all fair game for application in psychological warfare and covert operations.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I hear what you're saying, and it's basically what you're saying also with the direction of where, for example, America, the West has gone. It's like if you've begun on that path and you roll in that direction, you'll end up there eventually. We can even, of course, look at Britain, for example, which has adopted more of the Fabian way, Fabian society or Fabian socialist society, right, of gradualist and a reformist way, basically, to implement mechanisms of control, through socialism. So there's a lot of different methods out there.
Absolutely. And the result is ultimately the same, though. And so it really does come back to what philosophy, what political philosophy, what is your worldview based on? And so if your philosophy is liberalism, it's going to lead certain ways, and we see that being enacted today. And I don't just mean the standard in America. Of course, we have liberalism of the leftist variety, and in Europe, liberalism is more sort of right-wing libertarian capitalist. Those are false distinctions. I'm talking about philosophical liberalism. So if you internalize philosophical liberalism, then you have a certain worldview, then you'll take certain steps to enact it. And ultimately it will lead to what we see today. It's not an accident that what you look at in the media and what might really shock and horrify you, the various spectacles that are going on, or the strange phenomena that really, really disgust us, even if about children being taught how to commit various sexual acts when they're in school as part of their education program. All that has an underlying philosophical basis. So
I agree. And you know, it's mechanisms of controlling people, and I think we have a large faction of people still believing that, you know, this is something good, and it's about individual expression, and this is the way to go. But I mean, look at what's happening now with this tyrannical, you know, political correctness and crippling control of the language. I mean, soon enough we're into thought control area where you can't think certain things, and it's really going against human nature, and that is done, I think, in a way to ultimately not only self-censor people, but to get them to a point where they are very much more easily manageable and controlled, and this is the way they're using it, you know.
Absolutely, and it is war against human nature. And it's very tragic. I think that Dostoevsky said it best in his novel Demons, when through his theoretician of revolution, Shigalov, he pointed out that in order to construct the perfect society, to have perfect freedom, you needed to implement complete tyranny. He said proceeding from, so beginning with the idea of total freedom, I end in complete tyranny, with total despotism. So that really encapsulates the entire dialectic of liberal thought, of where things lead, that notion of freedom or egalitarianism, or all these things that are held out as good, and that nice, normal people were taught, hey, this is a worthy goal, ultimately leads somewhere else, much different. That's just part of the cunning of history, and really, I think, points to complete divorce from the transcendent bases of society, we're completely cut off from our faith, our heritage, our family. All those things don't matter anymore, because we're supposedly free individuals. In reality, all that does is cut off all those other interfaces that a normal society possesses, an organic society, and rather it's just the individual and the corporate state. And so the individual is nothing then.
Yeah, it sure is a hard way of learning it, and it's happening right now. But is there anything else we should talk about when it comes to we got into the illegals a little bit, the elite, you know, of the Soviet Russian intelligence that kind of went into the U.S., or I guess various countries, and the way they embedded themselves. Is there more we should discuss there?
Sure. The illegals are a really fascinating phenomenon in intelligence history. I think that, as you said, the grounds for it were laid in revolutionary Russia, because the Russian revolutionaries were living kind of this twilight existence where they had to match wits with the Tsar's secret police. They became very good at tradecraft, and tradecraft is what the Russians would call konspiratsiya, which of course, and you know, we think of the word conspiracy, but it really means tradecraft and secret operations and operating in cells, things like that. So the Russian, the Soviet secret police had a leg up on other intelligence services as far as carrying out covert action, different political influence operations. They were very adept at that. But really, the illegals were the elite of Soviet intelligence, because they were deep cover agents, or rather officers, who would be inserted into target countries and assume false identities. And it became a system, a very sophisticated system, that took years of training. It would take just 5 years minimum to train a competent illegal who would be ready for his mission. There's something in the Russian culture that points to this affinity with deep cover intelligence. It's very interesting how you can even go back to Dostoevsky in his Pushkin speech, and how Dostoevsky talks about in there, this is shortly before he died in 1881. His Pushkin speech was in 1880, but Dostoevsky talks about Russia's, that the Russian people have a certain capability for synthesis and a universal aspiration while still retaining their identity. And he gives, of course, as the example, the prime example of that, Pushkin, who wrote these various poems and ballads about different cultures and was very much able to get inside their head and express their cultural, their different characteristics and aspirations, dreams, and so on. Pushkin was very good at that. And Dostoevsky kind of says that Pushkin's genius that way is a Russian genius. So that carries over even into espionage. The Russians have a definite affinity for this type of deep cover espionage. And there's really nothing like it in the world of taking on foreign identities, of becoming a completely different person. Other than, I would say, the only other people who are that good at human intelligence are probably the Israelis. The Israelis are also do the type of deep cover legal intelligence operations. Although the Israeli case is different from a standpoint of cultural origins, of course, that with the Jewish diaspora and the way they operated.
It's like they've been embedded, if you will, in various countries for such a long time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that ties back to the beginning of the history of the illegals. In the beginning of the Soviet period, in the 20s, 30s, there were, of course, in the Cheka, which was the Soviet secret police, and within the Cheka, there was the foreign department, the INO, which was responsible for foreign intelligence. There were, of course, many Jewish officers. Later on, that would change. By the 40s, that really already, say the late 40s, that already was not the case anymore. So there is a tie-in there, but I would say that the Russian system of deep cover intelligence, of illegal intelligence, is something different. It's something unique. There's something unique to the Russian people in that way. Not that all Russians could do this, but that they would put that much time and training and funding and effort and willpower into becoming completely different people, especially from the perspective of a foreign nationality. It's pretty amazing. I've read and I've heard various comments by illegal officers that they of course have their preferences as far as which nationality is easiest to become. They have said veterans of the illegals, which in the KGB was Directorate S, veterans of Directorate S have said that it's easiest to become a German or an American. But really, they were adept at masquerading at all types of nationalities. You have even the case of Soviet illegals, Russian illegals who were inserted into Japan, and of course the Russians were able to use Central Asians and in some cases perhaps other nationalities in the Russian Far East,
right,
who could act as Japanese nationals, or maybe they masqueraded as Uyghurs or something like that. But it's truly amazing. So the Americans is real in the sense that there are actually Russian intelligence officers, and there were Soviet intelligence officers who could and can masquerade as foreign nationalities. The most amazing example of this, I would say, is probably from World War II. you had an NKVD special agent named Nikolai Kuznetsov, and Kuznetsov was a Russian gentleman who was born in a village in Siberia, in West Siberia, and just to a normal peasant family. And Kuznetsov had an amazing ability for languages for whatever reason. It was just a God-given talent. And so Kuznetsov, who was born in 1911, he would die in 1944. So he was only around 33 years old. But Kuznetsov was a master at German, and he could imitate several dialects of the language. So he was sent behind enemy lines in occupied Ukraine. And Kuznetsov masqueraded as a German Wehrmacht officer over a period of years during the war, as an infantry officer in the Wehrmacht, and posed as a Prussian, a native of Königsberg, in order to carry out various intelligence operations, including assassination, sabotage. He kidnapped a German general, as well as assassinated the highest judicial official in the Reichskommissariat of Ukraine. So it's pretty amazing that this guy, he could pull that off. But that's kind of a testament to something in the Russian culture that would enable that, as well as this illegal intelligence system.
Interesting. Now, let's see how is things today with this? Is there still ongoing? Obviously, we have the SVR, or the Foreign Intelligence Service in Russia and whatnot. What do we know about it today, and what is its goals, do you think, today?
The SVR has the same goals as far as gathering intelligence and strategic forecasting for the Russian leadership. But yes, the SVR is certainly very active, like any good intelligence service would be. And they still have, as the KGB did, Directorate S, which is responsible for carrying out illegal intelligence operations. The last case that we know of, that which was a big one, was 5 years ago in 2010. In June 2010, a ring, or what the what the FBI called a ring of illegals, of around 10 Russian officers and assets were arrested. Some of those were illegals, and they were very adept at what they were doing, which was penetrating into circles of influence in the United States, higher policy type institutions. One of the illegals was a guy named Donald Heathfield, and of course that wasn't his real name. He was a Russian, but I think his real name was Bizrukov. But this guy Donald Heathfield got a master's from Harvard, was responsible for creating some special business forecasting software, and was building ties within U.S. Higher policy circles. So it's very real as far as what the illegals carry out. We're not really sure what exact agents they were running. The FBI didn't, of course, say any of that. But the fact that 10 were rounded up and arrested is of course, it from the FBI perspective is a great success, and from the SVRs is a great disaster. That was actually the result of betrayal by a which is usually the case in instances like these. That was the result of a betrayal by a colonel in the SVR who was running the American section in Directorate S. His name was Alexander Pateyev, and you can actually even find the guy's picture online. He was a long-term KGB officer. He had served in Afghanistan in a special unit called Zenit, a special forces unit. And he, at some point, probably in the 2000s. We're not sure exactly when, as far as public data goes, but Pateyev became a CIA agent. He started working for the CIA, and consequently, he gave away much of the SVR's illegal network in the United States. So from that time, I think you could say that Directorate S has certainly for the past 5 years has been rebuilding its operations and really cleaning house. There were various elements to Pateyev's defect. He defected to the United States. So his betrayal / defection was tied to various circumstances that from an intelligence point of view would be crazy to it was a lapse. His wife was living in the United States, things like that shouldn't have been permitted from the Russian perspective. So there of course, I would think that the SVR Directorate S has been reorienting, refocusing their operations and of course their operational security from that time.
Well, there's so much more to discuss here, Mark, and in the next segment, we're going to get more into KGB, of course, the Spetsnaz. There's tons of different groups and talk about some of the things that they've been involved in and, of course, how they infiltrated into to Britain. I know you've written about, the Kim Philby and all these kinds of people. But I just wanted to ask you before we take a short break here and talk more about your website here, but did you ever get a hold and read some of the Mitrokhin archives?
Mitrokhin. I did read the Mitrokhin archives. Yes, and it's very interesting what he was able to smuggle out. Of course, it does show the depth and the breadth of KGB operations in the West. With that, those archives and those various revelations with defectors, I would just say that we just have to remember that it always comes with the political agenda of the powers that be in the West. You just
exactly.
have to keep that in mind too.
Exactly. Yeah.
They'll always promote their angle on things. So everything should just be taken with that in account. Whatever foreign policy objectives the elites might have, those will get carried over into these revelations by defectors or by people like that. So
yeah, and who knows what they omit or take away, or you know, there's always things behind all of this. But I mean, it was the British intelligence historian Christopher Andrew who ended up writing two books on this: The Sword and the Shield in 92, and then The KGB and the Battle for the Third World in 2005. And I have two copies. I haven't been able to get through them yet. I wanted to read some of the things in there, but that was my feeling too. You know, it's like very interesting, but as always, every time it's like, take it with a grain of salt. How is they're seeking to spin this and in what way? And, you know, but it's some interesting stuff in there for sure.
Sure. Yeah. And everyone has their angle. Everyone has their so-called spin. And so what I'm trying to do with Espionage History Archive is kind of show that there's so much rich material in Russian that hasn't been translated. I would just like to get that out there. Not because it's, of course, everyone omits and everyone, but nonetheless, I try to at least demonstrate to English speaking audiences that there's a lot of information and a lot of resources that are available that we should look at besides what only gets published in the West. So,
yep, absolutely, very good. Well, Mark, tell us about some of the websites that you write for. Do you have any plans to write any books about any of this, or are you just kind of churning out a lot of the material now on the websites?
Yeah, I enjoy kind of churning out the material. It is a nice hobby, but eventually, yes, I would enjoy writing a book at some point, maybe about one of these illegal intelligence officers. That would be a fascinating story. And of course, these subjects have been covered in Russian, but not so much in English. So I would really like to get that down one day and share it with the world. I think that would be neat. My sites are souloftheeast.org and espionagehistoryarchive.com. SoulOfTheEast.org deals mostly with philosophy and culture, some geopolitical history, things of that nature, while espionagehistoryarchive.com is focused on the history of Russian intelligence operations.
Right, very good. We've had a couple of the writers that write for Soul of the East as well. There's a lot of good things on there, a lot of good writers. So I suggest people, you know, check it out. And then also, of course, go ahead. Do you want to mention something more?
My friends, Daniel Spaulding, who's been on with you, as well as Jay Dyer, write for Soul of the East. And it's really enjoyable working with them. And so, we have a lot of great material there. As far as culture, philosophy, geopolitics, how these things intertwine, it's a cool website. So I do recommend checking out.
You bet. And of course, as we pick up here shortly in the second, we'll talk more about some of the things that Mark has written and written about on espionagehistoryarchive.com. So take a look at that in the break, and we'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Stay with us, Mark. We'll return shortly.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to learn I must return from Russia. Love. I've seen places, faces, and smiled for a moment, but oh, you haunted me so. Still my tongue tied, young pride would not let my love for you show. In case you'd say no, to Russia I flew, but there and then I suddenly knew you'd care again. My running around is through. I fly to you from Russia with
as we pick up in the second hour, we are going to speak more about, among other things, Cold War tensions, Kim Philby, the betrayal of the West, and the drive towards a technocratic world state with the liquidation of humanity as the ultimate goal. We speak about degeneracy and the willingness to destroy in our times without any appreciation for the efforts of what it takes to build something up and create what we have today. An interesting discussion up ahead here with Mark Hackard, so don't miss the second hour, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to hear more. We have this and all our previous programs in full at redicemembers.com. So head on over there and sign up and tune in. And don't forget, you can comment on the shows as well. So join in on the discussion and let us know what you think. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break right here, and then we'll be back with more in the second hour.